Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome. Thank you for joining. As you can tell, I'm still a little sickish. My voice is still a little fucked up. The trip to New York that I just got back from today, and I'm talking to you now. This is now, well, this will be the day after my show on IFC, Maron, premieres with the first two episodes last night. I hope you liked it. It's definitely different. We're going a different direction with the same guy. Not a happy direction initially, but is it ever? Isn't that the big question? If you did miss it, I can direct you to these other places. Today, the day after the show, you can go to IFC.com. You can go to Amazon. You can go to iTunes to pick up those episodes. We're all very proud of this season and very excited about it and very interested in how it is received. But I love it, and it was a great experience for me. So I hope you enjoy that. I don't know if you saw me on Fallon the other day. I guess I'm going to toot my own horn this whole fucking show, because there were a couple of, I would say, for me, lifetime highlights. In very subtle ways, but very profound to me, and I want to share them with you because, you know, I'm not at the top of the world, but I am experiencing some nice things, and I appreciate them, and I would like to share them with you if that's okay. Why do I have to disclaimer? You know, why am I offering you a disclaimer for relative happiness? You know, if you're going to stop listening because I'm not as much of a dick as I used to be, or I'm not as disgruntled as I used to be, well then I would encourage you to wait, because if I know myself, these things come back around, or don't. But today on the show, I'm very excited to have Ali Wong, her special Baby Cobra, which I got to watch. It premieres tomorrow, Friday, May 6th. Was one of the best stand-up comedy specials I've seen in a long time. I met Ali years ago. She featured for me or opened for me. I can't remember. I talked to her about it up in San Francisco, and I knew she was like a force. She's very specifically focused. She's got, she just has endurance. She'll fucking deliver her shit. She's raw. She's smart. She's got fucking guts, and her jokes are good, and it's provocative. And I need you to watch this special because I fucking loved it. It's got a surprise ending in a way, and it's just great. It's just fucking raw, beautiful comedy. You don't see this kind of shit that often. Personal, raw, dirty, smart fucking comedy. And she delivers it. When she sent me the link to her special, I'm like, oh my God, what is it? Because I know I like her. I know I like her style, and I know I like what I've seen. But like, I watched this special, I'm like, oh, fuck yes. She's out there 7 months pregnant, doesn't even really mention it for 2/3 of the special. It was just fucking, can I say this about a woman? It was ballsy, man. It is a ballsy comedy special. And I loved having her. And there's a surprise during the interview, something that I've never experienced and I don't think has ever happened in this garage. So look forward to that. So New York City, folks. New York City. It was raining and shitty the whole time we were there. We're both getting sicker, right? You know, I'm doing a little press here, a little press there. right? And then I go, here's the funny thing. Lin-Manuel, the creator and writer and star of Hamilton, I had heard was a big fan of WTF, and I'd never met him before. And the plan was I was going to go see Hamilton and then interview him. And we didn't have time to do the interview because the following day he got all these Tony nominations, and I had a big press day, and I had Jimmy Fallon show. But here's the beauty. All right. Hamilton is great. And I'm obviously not the first guy to say that, but it's great for reasons that that are new to me, because I don't go to musicals that often. And I saw two and I enjoyed both of them. And, you know, after the first act, there was part of me in both of them like, how much more could there be? And then the second act, it's like, oh, it all comes together and it's fucking amazing. But the thing about Hamilton is that not only is it a unique history lesson about a sort of, sidelined historical figure among the founders, but it's done in a way that it is risky and it's provocative and it's human. But the way it's framed, the entire thing becomes an immigrant story. It becomes the story of the founding of America, and it's an America for all types of people. And it's a uniquely New York show because it takes place in New York, and it's got a New York flavor, both current and from the 1700s. And it's designed so anybody can play these roles, because America is for everybody. Lin-Manuel Miranda, the guy who created it, played Alexander Hamilton. Aaron Burr was Leslie Odom Jr. Great. George Washington, played by Christopher Jackson. Great. King George, I believe, was Rory O'Malley. He was great. I'm not sure if this is the most current cast, because I'd heard that maybe there's two guys that played that. I hope not. Eliza Hamilton was great. Angelica Shuler and David Diggs, who played Lafayette, and Thomas Jefferson, was amazing. Amazing. It was everything that they say it is. You know, it is a musical. So, I mean, don't go expecting, to leave and your cancer is cured. I mean, it's a musical, and it's a great musical, and I don't see a lot of musicals. It reminded me of Jesus Christ Superstar. You know, it had a darkness to it that was elevated, and everything is like, the resolution is like, the beginning of America. So, anyways, I was happy to have seen it, but here's what happens, okay? So at intermission, the house manager comes up to me and says, Lynn wants you to come backstage and say hi, just meet me over there at that door. And I'm like, of course, So the play ends, it's a standing ovation. It's beautiful. Standing ovations are beautiful when you get them and when you're part of them. The cast is taking their bows, and there's a lot of people up there. There's about 30 people. They do a curtain call, and they all bow, and then they start to walk off stage, and I'm watching him. Lin-Manuel is walking off stage. He turns, as he's walking off stage to a standing ovation of his show, he turns and somehow looks directly at me and mouths, Boomer Lives. Oh my God, and it was just such a private, beautiful, large moment for me, because who's going to know, and I just saw it directly. I was looking right at him and he did it, and I couldn't fucking believe it. It was so fucking sweet and beautiful. It made me feel special, people. It made me feel special. And I went back backstage, we had a nice conversation, and I met Christopher Jackson as well. And, we made plans where, I'm going to go back and talk to him, and I'm excited to talk to him. I'm excited to learn about theater, and I've been doing that. It's exciting. It's a new thing. It's a new thing. And so that was a thrilling part of the New York trip. You hear me? Dig it. So, okay, Jimmy Fallon. I personally love Jimmy Fallon. Great guy, fun guy. I'm always happy to see him. And I was excited that they let me come on The Tonight Show, because I had not done The Tonight Show. I've only done one other Tonight Show. So I go to a 30 Rock. Sarah goes with me, hanging out, getting ready to go on, changing my shirt. And Lorne Michaels just walks in. Hey, how's it going? How you doing? I'm like, what? Huh? Like, he just dropped by to chat. And he hung out for about 5-10 minutes, just talking, asked me how I was doing, what was going on, how I was feeling. We talked about Louis for a little while and about comedy. And he said, all right, I got to go across the hall and go to work. I'm like, all right, nice to see you. It was, I don't know what to tell you, people. I don't know what to say. It was a very nice thing. And I was excited to see him. It's very nice where, you know, where I've got this place in the world that's mine. I don't really need anything from anybody. I really don't. And I like talking to people and I like doing what I do. But I just, you know, I'm okay. I'm okay where I'm at. And it was nice that, you know, I don't think we're going to be hanging out. Like, I don't know that we're going to go out to dinner or anything. But it was a cool experience for me. All right. It was nice. It was nice to be relaxed and not need anything and just have a chat with a guy that, you know, I've, you know, got to know by talking to him on this show. And he just happens to be Lorne Michaels. Is that okay? Can I have that experience? All right, look, here's what I got to tell you. I'm serious about Ali Wong. I'm serious that you should watch his special. It's called Baby Cobra, premieres on Netflix tomorrow, May 6th. I'm not being paid by Netflix. She kind of blew me away. And I was excited about that. And I'm glad that this timed out and we could have her on the show and talk to her because she's a great comic. So let's talk now. Embrace yourself. There is a, what am I saying that for? It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing that happens. And all right, so this is me and Ali Wong. How old is this kid now?
She's almost 5 months.
She's 5 months.
Yeah.
A girl. You had a girl.
A girl.
Yeah. Only seeing you at the Comedy Store, it's just like, oh, she's pregnant. And then like, oh, she must have. Yeah. So I don't know. Like you, like our lives only cross in that way. So I guess, well, everything went all right. There she is in her sweatpants without the, without the baby.
Yeah. I only wear sweatpants now.
Yeah.
I can't handle any buttons, any zippers. I can only pull.
Why?
It's too much, dude. It's like when you have a kid, it's awesome. And it's not, for me, it hasn't been as hard as everybody says it was.
Uh-huh.
But it's relentless.
Yeah.
So like any way you can shave off minutes, let's do it.
Yeah.
So like a button, gonna get in my way of going to taking a pee, go taking a shower.
Yeah.
Cutting it out. No more buttons. Yeah.
And then you have to deal with the kid constantly. When do you start getting help to deal with the kid?
I got help 2 months out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
So I've been having help. So I complain about it a lot on stage, but really it's been pretty great. And not, like I said, not as hard as everybody said it was
going
to be. That's because she's a chill baby and also because, you know, people complain a lot about the lack of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're a comic and you had to do the road when you're not famous and you have to do like radio and fly to horrible parts in the United States and then get up in the morning to drive to another horrible part in the United States to perform for like a lackluster crowd, that was really hard.
Well, it sounds, you made it sound so good. Comedy.
Comedy? Yeah. I mean, when you're not like an overnight success and you're like,
you don't gotta tell me.
The long road, you know, you have like the long, longer road. It's like, it's, you know, and you're doing the road like that.
I fucking loved your special. I watched it.
Oh, thanks, man.
It's like one of the best specials I've seen in a long time.
Oh my God, that means so much.
Does it?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I always liked you and I'm trying to remember. Like, I had this thing. Did you feature for me in San Francisco once?
I hosted for you fresh off of one of your divorces.
Yeah.
I don't know which one it was.
Must have been like 2006?
Yes.
Seven?
I think so.
Right.
And to be honest, like, everybody was hyping up this guy, Marc Maron.
Yeah.
And everything. And, like, you were a legend. And I was like, oh, my God, I cannot wait to host for him.
Yeah,
and you were depressed.com. And the whole set was just you sitting on the stool trying to process your divorce.
Yeah.
I swear to God, it was as if you had just gotten divorced, like, literally right before you got on stage.
Probably. She probably just left me.
Yeah.
And that was one of your first opening gigs?
It was.
So when was that? Like, so give me the date. Was it 2006?
I think it was 2006.
Right. So yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I remember like you were so fucking funny. And I actually had one of these things where I had years later, this was a few years ago, like I was doing a bit about yoga.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, why does this feel familiar? It wasn't like, Didn't you used to do a like a bitter yoga instructor bit?
Yes.
Right.
How they like, gosh, I forgot about that. You know how they do all their diatribes
in the beginning of class? Right.
And then some, and then they'll just be like, okay, you know, we're going to really focus on breathing. And I really need to focus on my breathing because I'm having bad thoughts, you know, because my I'm in a custody battle with my husband and I need strength. And you're just like, oh, get me out of here. yeah, so I think I did used to do something about
right.
that.
Right, well, I did a guy, that. I just did a guy in class, you know, like that, the sort of in, I do the position, I'd be in just hating on the teacher, like, oh, fuck you, this
oh,
is
bull- yeah.
It was different, but like, I remembered, like, oh, she did the yoga teacher thing, like the bitter, yo- like sort of, that was funny, why don't you do that anymore?
I don't know, things really-
Oh, no, they go away, right?
They come and go for me.
When did you start doing comedy?
Right after stand-up comedy, I started doing it right after college. Maybe when I was 23 years old, so that was like in 2005.
And you grew up in the Bay Area the whole time?
I grew up in San Francisco proper.
Right in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Like what neighborhood?
In Pacific Heights.
Really?
Yeah, right by Temple Emmanuel.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Yeah. And you, like I, watching the special, like it's weird because your special, like there's actually a spoiler possibility.
Right. Maybe don't spoil that.
No, I won't. But like it's like it was so fucking beautiful and crass and fucking ballsy, and you're all pregnant, dressed in tight dress. I fucking loved it.
Oh, thanks,
because I get you know, it's like just being straight up honest and being, you know, like as smartly filthy as you were was really smart.
Oh, thanks. It's very I mean, I don't like, you know, a lot of people I think have intentions about the kind of comic they want to be. And it's so hard to just be funny.
Yeah.
And that's all I ever wanted to be. And even now it's like, what is going to make them laugh and what's going to make me laugh?
And also
that's
honest.
That's the goal.
Yeah.
Yeah. And honest.
Yeah.
Like I don't want to do, there's some, like I mean, hopefully I don't do hacky stuff and I don't want to because it doesn't make me laugh. Even if it makes other people laugh, make me laugh, then I don't want to do it.
Well, the funny thing is about your approach to being a woman is like there are like, you know, the hacky avenues.
Right.
And there really isn't any.
Yeah.
And everything that you bring up that it, what I thought was amazing is like not only does what you're talking about, you know, whether it be, you know, shitting or anal fucking that like not only does it make men uncomfortable, but it makes women uncomfortable, but they're so happy that there's a revelation, you know, like they're like you literally do stuff that you know in depth, not like just pay lip service to, that women do not fucking talk about in public
or
that whole prostate thing. See, I'm just gonna drop little nuggets.
Right. Well, because it's true for me, you know.
Right.
Like
right,
that's the honest thing. It's like, you know, I'm like obviously kind of like a perverted, gross, freaky person, and I mean I do talk in my special about how it's like sticking my fingers up a man's butthole, a straight man's ass, is so exciting to me.
Yeah.
It's like I went to Disneyland recently and I got this special hookup where I got to skip all the lines, got to go on all these awesome roller coasters. None of that was exciting to me than sticking my fingers up a straight man's butthole. Like when you're the first to do it, it's so exciting. It's so like, because there's all this like, besides the physical stuff, it's like, I mean, at my age and like at this point in my life, sex is like 99% mental shit anyways.
Right.
And for me to get aroused, it's like doggy style spanking.
Yeah.
Don't cut it no more.
Yeah.
I have to wage psychological warfare on a man in order
your husband
for me to come.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
but like also the way you characterize the dude sort of being sort of like, no. Yeah. I just like, I don't know what it is, whether it's San Francisco or like, because there is both your comedic style and also the sexuality that you're exposed to just by living there culturally.
Yeah.
Like, you know, with the size of that, especially the male gay community, you're like, you hear about fucking everything. And you, you know, you live with it all the time and you talk to people about it. And that like the intensity of those conversations and the type of sexuality that happens in that town almost publicly.
Yeah. I mean, and I grew up you know, my dad was a doctor, and he
really
worked in the ER.
What kind of doctor?
He was an anesthesiologist.
Okay.
And he would tell me about all the crazy things he would see as a result of people's, like, sexual adventures. He would see, you know, in the ER.
Yeah.
Men would come in with, like, 50 Barbie heads in their
Get the
butt.
Fuck out of here.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff.
We just used, oh, I don't want to, well, I don't know when this is going to go on. We just used a guy putting a Barbie doll head in his ass on my TV show.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
And I'm glad to see that there's a, you know...
It's a thing, because you can see, again, how, like, sex is, like, a lot of it is mental stuff. Like,
right.
Why does that arouse you? Maybe because you like to play with Barbies, and who knows?
Well, fetish, the world of fetish is like, God, that's, you can't even explain it.
There's exactly.
Nothing. Yeah. So really? So
and he would talk openly about all that stuff.
So he's a pretty progressive guy?
Yeah.
In a way?
Yeah, my dad was really, really progressive. Both my parents were, yeah.
And you have just one brother?
I have a brother and two sisters.
Oh, yeah?
I was the last. They're all 10 years and up.
So your mom is really in her 80s?
My mom is, she's in her late 70s uh-huh. now. Yeah.
Yeah. And your dad's?
He's gone.
He's gone.
He passed away about 5 years ago or so.
So you're growing up in San Francisco, and, like, just judging by the set, you know, you were pretty wild.
Yeah, I was. Like, in high school, I went to, like, a private school
right.
and did a lot of drinking.
Yeah.
And I was...
But you grew up, like, middle class, like, comfortable, right?
Yeah. Totally comfortable. Yeah. And I mean, for no good reason. I didn't have a lot of angst or anything. It was just like...
Fuck it.
Something to do. And I drank a lot. At one point, I think I remember I drank in high school, like, two and a half of those 40 ounces of Old English.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Yeah, blackout.
Yeah, I'm surprised that I'm still here.
Yeah. What about drugs?
No, I was not that big into drugs. And then because weed always made me paranoid and I was scared to do anything else.
Yeah.
So I haven't, and since then, I haven't really been into drugs. Like, I kind of stopped in high school.
Yeah.
And then I met my husband, who is really into ayahuasca.
Ugh.
And then we...
How old are you guys?
We're both like... I'm 33 and he's 34.
Right.
And then I hadn't done anything except for weed since high school.
Yeah.
And it was like 0 to 100.
You went and did it. What? Did you do it in this sort of, like, environment with other people, the whole ayahuasca thing?
Yeah. We've done it a couple times together now.
Yeah? Like, is it...
At first I did it just... to prove to him that I could be his, like, warrior princess,
mm-hmm.
because I really liked him. And I was like, oh, like...
It's part of the
looks,
test.
Yeah, like, it's part of the test. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, but then I mean, a lot came out and it was wonderful.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, let's back up. So your husband is, like, what's he do for a job?
He works in startup stuff now.
Oh, so he's like, one, you know, he's...
He's like a business dude.
He's like
business
gambling.
Tech dude.
Looking for the app money?
That's when he's doing his own startup thing.
Yeah.
But now he's like with an established startup. But before, I mean, he'll go back and forth between like a corporate thing, his thing, and then another
doing all
startup
right?
thing. Yeah, he's doing great.
Oh, good. So, all right. So this is a grown man and he's
a grown man.
But he's obviously...
Like, he's like an Asian dude with Aztec undertones.
Uh-huh.
It's very hard to understand him.
Where did he grow up?
He grew up in D.C.,
with like another middle class guy.
Yes. Like,
is he in your special? He went to Harvard Business School.
Yes.
So very cultured.
Very cultured.
Was his parents in politics or something?
No. Do you know those little octopuses that came in your cereal when we were younger that like you would throw on the wall and that were sticky?
Yeah.
His dad was like the distributor of those. And then his mom worked at the World Bank. They're awesome.
The distributor of sticky octopuses?
Yeah. And then he had a show on the East Coast called Dr. Fad.
Yeah. This is his dad?
This is his dad.
Yeah.
So it's so funny because my dad was like a really unconventional, quirky Asian guy who always surprised people with his quirkiness. And then when now my friends meet my husband's dad, they're like, wow, that's so crazy.
What are the odds? That you both have these same weirdo dads.
Yeah.
But his dad's what, Japanese?
Japanese, yeah.
And your dad's Chinese?
My dad's Chinese.
And his mom's Filipino?
Yes, and my mom's Vietnamese. So we gave birth to Asia.
All of it.
All of it, yeah.
What's the kid look like?
She looks Japanese.
She does.
Very, whatever. She can look like however she wants to look like, right. But I wish she looked a little bit more like me. But part of me is...
What do you think you look like? Thai?
I don't know. When I'm in Vietnam, people think I'm Japanese, but I think that's because of the way I dress.
Mm-hmm.
And because I wear like interesting glasses.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but most people can guess that I'm Chinese.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
So
I'm kind of Southeast Asian.
But like your dad, like did they speak Chinese?
Yes. So it's kind of, you know, a lot of my other friends who are Asian American, who I went to UCLA with, their parents came more recently.
Yeah.
But my mom came from Vietnam in the 1960s, which is very unusual because most Vietnamese people came after 1975.
Was she leaving the war?
No. She came on a scholarship to just study at a college in the Midwest.
God, she got lucky, huh?
She got really lucky. And then my dad was born and raised in San Francisco, Chinatown.
Oh, wow.
And he grew up...
In Chinatown. Like, wow.
Super poor. No running water, stretched up, like slept in a twin bed with his two sisters and his mom, like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory style, feet by the head.
Yeah.
No running water.
In Chinatown, San Francisco,
had to like fish out vegetables out of the garbage.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Crazy.
With his mother. So like when he succeeded, were they around to appreciate and enjoy that? And
yeah. Yeah.
That's absolutely. A hell of a story.
Yeah.
So they were first generation, his parents.
Yeah, his parents came here.
Wow.
Through Angel Island.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Which is that in San Francisco?
That's
like the Ellis Island of the West Coast?
Yes.
Which is all probably Asian immigrants.
It's all Asian immigrants. His dad, my grandfather, came when he was 8 years old to work as a houseboy.
In San Francisco?
In Monterey.
Oh my God.
But he came when he was 8 years old by himself. And we have a picture from Angel Island.
Yeah.
This black and white picture. And he's so small. It's like it.
Did you know him?
Barely. He passed away when I was in second grade.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really have much. And then I couldn't communicate with my grandma on my mom's side at all. So I didn't really have
She's
much of a
Vietnamese.
Relationship with her. Yeah.
Is she here?
No.
Oh.
Yeah.
So you don't speak any of the languages?
No, I speak conversational Vietnamese, but that's because I went and did this program in college and after college to learn Vietnamese. But it's like I have the proficiency of maybe like a second grader.
Right, which is kind of cute probably to some people.
Not to Vietnamese people. They're like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Just speak English. And I thought my mom would be excited, and she's like, this is so exhausting. Trying to hear your long-ass, slow, boring sentences about what time is it, basic shit. Let's talk about real shit in English, please.
Does she talk like that?
No, she doesn't talk like that, but the spirit is like that.
So now, like, with something like that, were they discouraged to be married because of the two, you know, like a Jew thing, like where it's sort of like, was your dad's mom like, don't marry a Vietnamese lady?
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then...
None of that baggage.
No. And my mom was banging.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's crazy when you have a mom who is so much, like you look at pictures of her and they're so much hotter than you will ever be. So it's like, I'm sure her, you know, my dad's parents were like, yeah.
Yeah.
Get it. You know?
Yeah. And where'd you meet your husband?
At a wedding. So he went to Sidwell. Which is where the like Obamas go to school.
A private school?
Yeah, private school in DC. And then I went to like the Sidwell of San Francisco. And then, so we went to school with all Jewish people.
Yeah.
And we went to this wedding in Napa where the bride, I went to high school with her and he went to high school with the husband.
Yeah.
We were the only Asian people at the wedding and everybody else was Jewish.
Yeah.
And I saw him and I was like, we were probably raised in the same economic bracket.
Yeah.
He's hot. I'm going to make this happen.
And you did.
And I did, yeah. And we turned out to click, and he turned out to be a lot more interesting and weird and like fun than I had expected. And it keeps going that way.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
That's a good story.
Yeah.
And but by that point, so like you met him at a wedding. How old were you? Were you already doing comedy?
Yeah. That was maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
So did he come watch you do comedy and have to...
He did. I sent him an email to come see me do a show because I was like, this guy, he's really good looking. He looks like Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah.
And I was like, I am going to get this guy with my looks. It's either he's going to like the funny or he's not going to like the funny. And that's my only shot. And so I invited him to a show and he loved it.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And then we went out on a, what I thought was a date, but he like actually borrowed money from me on our first date. And then I was like, oh, fuck, this is not a date. And then
he borrowed money.
He borrowed money from me
to pay for the date.
Yeah. And it was like one of those places in New York where you order at the counter and pick up your food
right
at the counter, and it was disgusting.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed. But then we just kept on going out.
Yeah. So all right, so that brings us, so he had graduated Harvard Business already, and he was and he was, when you met him, he was living in New York.
Yeah.
So you were kind of going back and forth and doing some comedy and like hanging out with him.
I was living in New York at the time too.
You were?
Yeah. So I lived in San Francisco for, I did comedy in San Francisco for maybe like 4 years, and then I lived in New York for like 2 years.
Doing comedy?
Yeah.
I guess I never came across you then.
Mm-mm.
What were you doing, like the alt rooms and shit?
Yes. Yeah. I was doing a lot of, doing the alt rooms,
yeah,
doing the clubs whenever I could.
Like comic strip?
Yeah.
Did you ever get in the cellar?
I did, but after I think I did towards the end.
Yeah.
And then I lived in New York again because I was on this ABC medical drama that was shooting in New York. And then I was at the cellar I was at the cellar.
You were acting in a medical drama?
I was.
And you had a regular gig?
Yeah. I played a quirky radiologist with agoraphobia, and I had a love arc with a plumber.
Which show was that?
It was called Black Box. Vanessa Redgrave was in it.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And that was just an acting gig?
That was just an acting gig, yeah. And it was great.
Wow. Really, how many fun episodes of that did it go?
13.
So it did a whole season?
It did a whole season. It was in the summer. It died.
Yeah.
As things do.
But you're dating your boyfriend, you're doing comedy, and you're on a TV show.
Yeah.
Everything's going good.
Yeah. It was one of the best times.
And then you come back here.
Then I come back here.
What brought you, like, how did it go? So you were in San Francisco doing comedy, then you go to New York to
do
comedy.
Yeah, and then it was like, in San Francisco, there comes a point where, I used to joke that there's this saying that people who live in New York have a lot of ambition and a lot of talent, and people who live in LA have a lot of ambition and no talent, and people in San Francisco go to Burning Man. And I was like, I felt that, and I was like, I gotta get out of here. Yeah. I can't, like, I had friends who their whole lives were built around like Burning Man and like Poetry Night at the Cafe. Yeah. That's what San Francisco used to be. It's not like, you know, not this like dickish tech town that it is now. And so I was like, I gotta get out of here. Like, and there was comics there who were just like ghosts who would just like, you know, your dream was to like get to be a feature at the Punchline, and they would just like be a feature forever. And
people,
I'm like, I can't
leave.
Do that.
Yeah, yeah. People don't leave. It's the weirdest thing. And like when you're there, I never quite understood. There's a lot of that sort of like, maybe not anymore because of the tech boom, but just, you know, culturally when I was there, I never knew what the fuck was going on, you know, just energy wise. Like, what are all, I got the gay community, but there was this whole other world of people that just seemed to be lost in between college and being 90.
Right.
You're like, what are they, what the fuck is happening, you know?
Yeah.
It's bizarre, man.
It's bizarre.
Like, there's something about, I think weed is just killing the will of so many people that just, and
there's
also,
like that, and they hacked the system.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many awesome social services in San Francisco, or like they found an apartment or something,
right,
and they just like, they hacked that shit.
Yeah.
And somehow, like, are able to live in this beautiful apartment. And, you know,
Just smoke weed,
working on that zine.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
Volunteering at 826 Valencia, like doing God knows, working at that nonprofit that takes, you know, children of color in hot air balloons once a year or something.
Yeah. And also there's just this thing about, you know, to be a big shot and big fish in a little pond. There's a lot of that there.
Totally.
And a lot of guys, like a lot of people would come down here and just fucking hit the wall and then
and
scramble
they give
back.
Up.
Yeah, on one turn.
Right.
Do you know what, like back in the day, like those comics you're talking about, the San Francisco guys, they'd come, they'd do an evening at the improv, and they're like, I guess that's it.
Exactly.
Like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I know.
It's hard to understand show business. Like, there's a whole generation of comics, like some people, and it's still that way, some people get into comedy to do comedy, and then they just expect show business to find them somehow. And I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You got to be full of anger and resentment and ambition. And
yeah,
you know,
and that takes years to build up, too, a callus. That's why it's like the comics that I like, they have to have that.
Yeah.
I only like comics who have been doing it for 10 years plus.
Yeah, I don't know what the hell's going on.
I would say maybe 15 years plus even, you know?
Yeah, because at least you know you're in the hands of a professional. You know, even if you don't like their comedy, you're like, that person fits up there. And
they have to go that thing. Like, I heard that awesome interview you did with Patrice O'Neill.
Oh, yeah.
And he talks about going on the roller coaster twice in this business. Mm-hmm. And I think I only want to listen to people who have been on the roller coaster, like, at least twice. You know, where they're not having as much fun on the second ride anymore because they're so filled with, like, anxiety that the roller coaster ride's going to end. Because it's so human. And I identify with that. And that's how life is, you know? That's how, like, relationships are. It's like, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, with my parents, by the time they got to me, they understood the concept of dating. They didn't understand that with my siblings at first, I think. Like, the first person you date, you don't marry. But they understand, like, you ramp up, you think you're going to marry this person, and then the relationship goes sour, and it dies. And you move on, and the next person you find is better. You know, and like, with that's...
Or you just repeat the same thing over and over again.
Or you repeat the same... You go on the same roller coaster ride over and over again. It's just a different color,
and then
a
you
different
wonder
race.
One day why you're like, this is not even fun. I know when it's going to... Oh, here comes that thing.
And
But you must have been like, you know, if the stuff in your special is based on truth, your parents must have been like, what the fuck are we going to do with her?
Kind of.
Or they were over
it. They were over it. I mean, my sister is an unemployed lesbian, one of my sisters. So they're like, do whatever the fuck you want. Like, you make money, you know, great. And when they came to my shows and people were laughing in San Francisco, they couldn't believe it. And they were so proud. They're really supportive. They were like, you know.
You realized it. You did it. Even if,
like,
they don't get it.
And I had ambition. You know, they were like proud that I wanted to do something.
But you're like a real comic. I mean, you wanted to be a real comic. I mean, when you were coming up in San Francisco, who were you watching there? Because there was still, like, the one thing about San Francisco, when I lived there for that 2 years or whatever, like, it enabled a freedom of creativity on a comedy stage that no other place does.
Totally.
Like, it's built into the fabric of the city. Just sort of like, be yourself, you know, goes in. There's that whole kind of riff style that you kind of like are part of in a way. I can tell that some of the influences where you just sort of own the stage. You have freedom of mind and you do what you're going to do. You define yourself.
Yeah. I mean,
they'll indulge some noodling, San Francisco. They'll let you fucking dick off.
Totally. And it's part because there's like homeless people on the street at Civic Center BART station who are like talking your ear off, and people listen to them, you know. So it's like they'll listen to anybody. I mean, it was such a great place to come up.
And you were like 23 when you started.
I was 23.
Where'd you go to college?
UCLA.
You did the whole 4 years.
I did the whole four years.
Studying what?
Asian American studies. Yeah.
So you're on top of that shit. Got a handle on
I
it.
Feel.
You are Asian. Now you are Asian American studies. You've got it all covered.
Well, and it's so interesting because I thought I was so passionate about it at the time and I was so into it.
Yeah, what was the angle though? What did you think you were going to do with it?
I thought maybe I would be like a professor or something,
right? Yeah.
And then this other guy who was in one of my classes was talking about how after he finished college, he was not going to continue with like academia and Asian American studies and that he was going to go into the restaurant business.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, I mean, you know, do you want to study or do you want to be studied? And I was like, oh, I guess being studied sounds more glamorous.
That was an Asian guy?
It was an Asian guy.
That was because that was a very simple philosophical kind of like almost Zen-like question.
Yeah, yeah.
there's something very Asian about the phrasing.
Totally. It was like a Yoda phrase.
Right, Buddha just came up to you through that guy.
Yeah, and I was like, but I was in this comedy group also in college.
Yeah.
So it kind of...
Sketch group?
A sketch group, yeah.
So the first time you did stand-up, was it like at the Punchline?
I think it was at the Brainwash Cafe in San Francisco, that place south of Market. Yes, it's a laundromat / cafe.
I think I was there when that started.
Full on homeless shelter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they'd have a show there.
They'd have a show there. And you'd sign up. You got to do like 3 or 5 minutes.
And there's all those washing machines, and you can eat there too, right? They had coffee and shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that place.
Yeah.
I remember when that was happening, like at the very beginning, maybe, when I went back up there. It was one of those things where, I mean, you started when that was happening. That shit wasn't happening when I started.
What, like shitty shows?
Well,
that
alt
were
kind of
awesome. Oh, yeah.
Like that. Like where it's sort of like, they, you know, there's this sort of idea. It's like, yeah, there's a show at a laundromat. Like, in what world would that be a good thing? Like, right. When I was coming up, if someone said, you want to do the show at a laundromat? I'm like,
oh,
what
now that's like the norm.
I know.
Now people like fight to get on these shows.
I know.
It's like, it's in a backyard.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's a secret email list. It's not even promoted on Twitter or whatever. Yeah. It's like, hey, how can I get on that show? I'll still do the shittiest shows.
I was doing them up till like a year or so ago, and then I realized, like, I don't need to. I'm not going to.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Just, I mean, recently, like, I was like, I got to be part of that. And
right.
I got to, like, that audience. And then, like, you know, one day, you know, I just was at, you know, at one of them, and I'm like, I just want to do real comedy.
Yeah.
At a real comedy place. You know, like, when you go to the store, you're like, this is like a real, this is where you do comedy.
Right.
For real.
Yeah. Well, that's become your, I mean, you're one of those people where that's kind of become your open mic.
Yeah.
That's become the
place can do it there now.
Where you feel safe.
Right.
I don't totally have that yet. And I don't know if I even want to have that place, because sometimes when the audience is so shitty.
At the store?
Not at the store, but like at these other shitty rooms.
Right.
When the circumstances are so shitty, you get that anger and then you blurt out
what
things.
You need. Is that how you write?
That's how I write.
Me too.
I never write. I only write on stage.
Me too.
I can't just sit. It all has to come from like pure emotion.
It's the best.
Yeah. And you just feel like something streaming out of your mouth, and you have like no pause between your brain and your mouth.
And then it's delivered.
It's delivered.
And it's the best.
It's great. But it comes from honesty and emotion and frustration.
Right.
And so that's why those rooms will always, I think, have value to me. And I am one of those comics too who's like, I'm so in love with the process of stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Like you know, on the chance, 1 times out of 10, that I'll get a new bit writing on stage.
Yeah.
I chase after that
all
the time.
It's the best.
Yeah. Like, and that's why, like with this kid, like I still can't help but go out a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, at night.
Well, it's like, it's our valve, you know, it's like where we actually have a voice that, you know, that I can't even explain it, but I don't meet many people that write like that, because I do it too. And then, you know, when you have part of a new bit, like it's working good enough and you're just waiting for it to finish itself.
Right.
When is this going to finish itself?
Yeah.
And then. And then one night it just comes and you're like,
right.
Oh,
thank God. There you were.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for you. Yeah.
It's the best.
It's the best.
Because, all right. So you're doing the laundromat. And then you're doing the punchline.
So, you know, Molly Schmink, the booker at the punchline.
Sure.
So great. Had this whole system.
She is great. I've known her since she was like 12, I think.
Oh, she's.
She was there when she was like 15.
She's been there forever.
Yeah.
And. So intimidating to me at first.
Well, she does that.
Yeah, but then like she's my friend now and I love her, and she's like, she's just like a, you know, now she's a friend. But it was so scary because there was this system. I don't know any club in any city that has this system where you wait in the back at the punchline every Sunday. You get to know all the comics, watch people's sets. There's 13 spots.
Yeah.
And you wait like 9 months to a year and a half to get one of those spots, your first shot.
Really?
Yeah. And so I waited every Sunday and watched, you know, the same comics go up, and, you know, people really wanted that. And then finally I got my first shot.
Yeah.
And all of these old, you know, older comics were like really sweet and gave a recommendation for me, and I ate it so hard. But then she gave me another shot 6 months later, and I did well. And then.
Did you let on that you were eating it, or just plow?
I just plow.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a plower.
Yeah, you are a plower.
Yeah. I don't like to let on. I'm like, what is the point?
Yeah.
I'm not going to come up with any new bits about that are valuable about bombing. I'm just going to,
But
to this day, I'm a plower.
Because sometimes you do, like you were doing that first spot in the original room sometimes, right?
Oh, yeah. I'll plow.
It's the worst.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to riff on like, are you from Australia? Blah, blah, blah.
Why they're still seating people.
Why they're still seating people. None of that has any value to me. That's not what I feel about talking about in my soul.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Then I'm like, it becomes this exercise in just practicing saying the words.
Yeah.
You know?
And you're conscious of that?
Yes, very conscious.
Like when you're up there plowing, like, because I'm not a plower, you know, I'll be
Oh, yeah, you're an acknowledger.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And because I'm like, I'm not going to let you do this to me.
Right.
I hold them responsible.
Yeah.
Is this how it's going to be? Fine.
Yeah.
But like when you're plowing, do you feel the bit not hit?
Yeah. And then I'll just keep going. I'll just, again, just
that's
keep
good.
Going.
I think that's a good.
Get to the end of the finish line.
Yeah.
So I ate it. And then 6 months later, she put me again and I did. Well,
but at that time, like, you're doing alt rooms, getting your chops.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think pretty quickly too, I started putting on like my own shows where I would headline, and I thought I had like 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And I would do 40 minutes at like the Dark Room in San Francisco, which is a black box theater.
Yeah.
And have like other people like Kevin Kamiya or whatever feature. And
that's the way to do it though, because like if I need to really write shit, like I'm going to start at the Steve Allen Theater for 2 months weekly, like every Tuesday over at the Steve Allen.
Yeah.
Just and be like $5 and I'm just, you know, lower your expectations.
Totally.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
So that was pretty not only dedicated, but it was a smart thing to do. Because like, even if you didn't have 40 minutes, at least you're doing 40 minutes.
Yeah, and like Moshe Kasher and Brent Weinbach had put on a lot of their own shows. And
are they your generation?
No, they're older. They started before me.
Did they?
They started maybe like 4 years before me. But because
I think he featured for me or opened for me when Moshe was like sort of disturbing looking.
Oh, hilarious.
You remember when he was all hip-hoppy and fucking weird and like you couldn't quite see what his personality was because he was so uncomfortable and angry?
He's like Madonna. He's gone through many awesome.
Well, now he's all sort of nice and clean and haircutted and he's got glasses that are sometimes colored pink. You know, but like when I first worked with him, he was like frightening in a way because he was so unformed and so clearly mad.
Yeah. And then gradually at the punchline, the goal is to like host.
Yeah.
And then you meet all of these awesome headliners like yourself and Dave Attell. Patrice
me on
O'Neil.
The wrong week, but me, I get you, it.
Yeah. Yes, to be honest, yes. Patrice O'Neill, who all helped me a lot when I moved to New York. Doug Benson. And then I think someone said to me, too, if you stay in San Francisco long enough to move up to feature at the Punchline, you stayed too long.
Right.
And then I was like, yeah. And I got, and then after 4 years, and I felt it, and I was like, I gotta go. And I want to go to New York, and I want to become like,
you want to be in show business,
a great comic.
Yeah,
yeah, I want to become a great comic.
Yeah,
is that's still the goal? You know, even when people say to me like, oh, are you still doing the stand up thing?
What the fuck?
And I still feel like so insulted, so hurt.
Yeah,
and I'm like, that is my thing. That's the thing that I always do.
Amateurs ruined it.
And I never got into stand up as like a backdoor to TV writing or acting. All of that is like a way for me to not do shitty shows anymore. Like when I go out on the road, like when I travel, I want it. Like that's why I'm hoping this special, you know, is a game changer for me, because I hope that when I travel and I'm away from my daughter for like a night or 3 days, that it's worth it and that it feels good, because I can work out stuff in LA. I love doing 15 minute spots in LA, but when I go on the road, like I don't want to do like 6 days in the last smoking club in America anymore.
Right.
You know, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't do that anymore.
Well, that, you know, that was sort of my realization when, you know, when I started this podcast and I was looking down the barrel at being broke and, you know, and being a comic for 20 years and being a headliner, I was like, I don't want to do that.
Right.
For my whole, like, what?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, all I ever wanted to be was a comic. And then I had this fluky success with this, this secret skill. And, but still, like, for me, like, I just got done shooting a season of my show, right? So now, like, I gotta put together another hour.
Yeah.
And there's that moment where you're like, I've only been doing Saturdays for 4 months because I'm shooting a TV show.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't fucking, how does that happen?
Yeah.
How do I do a new hour?
Yeah.
And then, like,
but then
I know
it feels so good, too, to,
one
like,
joke,
have that.
One joke.
Yeah.
Like, one new joke. Because I did the special, which not many people saw. And then I had to go out and do three shows that were hours at theaters, small theaters.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can't do all old stuff.
Did you do some old stuff?
I did a couple because the weird thing is like most people haven't seen my special. It was on Epics and now it's on Hulu and Amazon. Like, what am I thinking? That all 800 people
saw it and they're going to hold you accountable and they'll be like, seen it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Boom.
No new stuff. That's somebody we invent. That person lives in our head more than that. There's one totally dick who will do that, but whatever. Head. Fuck them.
Yeah.
But the thing was, is like, because of what you were talking about before, you know, that sort of like, you know, like, yeah. and just getting up there and like, this is where it happens, man.
Yeah.
And you don't even think that way. You like when, I don't know about you, but when I'm going out there, I'm not like, okay, I hope something happens. I do say that, but I'm like, I'm not hard on myself. Cause once I get up there,
yeah.
if I've got the rage or I've got the thoughts, they'll, you know, they'll come with the relationship mm-hmm. with the audience.
Yeah.
And I got one new chunk that I kind of polished over 3 weeks. That's a nice big bit. And I'm like, I'm going.
You're going. And you can't, and like that journey
yeah.
is like better than the result itself.
Oh, yeah.
That's why even like when a, you know, a special's done, I'm like, I'm not done with those jokes.
Yeah.
You know, like I keep adding to them.
Yeah,
still,
yeah, you're right.
Like, and I watch it over and I'm like, oh, I could have refined that so much better.
Right.
Like, it never ends.
Well, that's what happens when you write like we do. It's never finished.
Yeah.
You just expand the conversation.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And I'm still, like I said, I'm still so in love with that, you know? And
it's,
so
it's creative. It's being a good comic.
Yeah.
And you're a very good comic.
Oh, thank you.
Like that fucking special is great.
Thanks.
Like I've never seen like, you know, it's like rare that like, but I always like watching you, but the thing, cause of, you know, you've got fucking guts. And you're not afraid, and your style, I like, you know, people who like, you know, kick some balls.
Oh, thanks. I think it's also, there was this thing when maybe I was starting to, like, even now, maybe still, where it was like unfashionable to have energy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like,
look lazy,
be soft spoken, like, you know, because then it really speaks to the writing or something. And that's no fun.
Yeah,
I'm not
yeah.
into that.
Yeah, yeah.
So but like when I'm working stuff out, I will do that thing where I will be like very soft spoken to see, because I do want to see if just the material will stand on itself without the
Chris
energy.
Rock does that.
Yeah, I'm really into that.
Really?
I think that's a really good technique, because then once you pair it together with a big audience, then it's like, but you do want to, then if the material stands on its own with like, you being all soft,
yeah.
and it's like, okay, this is good.
Yeah,
this
yeah, yeah.
Good. Yeah.
So you go San Francisco, New York, and then what brings you to LA? Back to LA after, you know, after all
I
that.
I had gotten a manager, and then he was like, you need to come to LA for pilot season. And then I started working and doing some TV stuff, acting stuff. And then I just decided to stay. I was resisting it. And then one day I was just like, I'm going to decide to like LA.
Yeah.
And as soon as I made that decision and stopped being bitter about how you have to drive everywhere and how it's like superficial, whatever, and I embraced it, I loved it. And now I can't see myself living anywhere else. It's so authentically diverse. I'm from, you know, San Francisco now is whack.
Yeah.
Sorry, but it's whack. It's like so unaffordable, so not diverse.
Yeah.
You know, like my sister, I live in Culver City.
Yeah.
And my sister came with me to this comic book store like two blocks away. And she was like, there's a black dude running that comic book store. And it blew her mind. And she was like, in San Francisco, she was like, this is, you know, LA is so crazy. Like, you have access to like all this amazing Asian food.
Yeah.
And in San Francisco, it's just like all rich white and Asian people.
The mission is like unidentifiable now.
Yeah.
It's like, what is this? I lived at like 22nd and South Van Ness in 1992.
Yeah.
And it was like, the Wild West.
Right.
It was fucking crazy.
It was like The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was nuts. And there's still that one corner where you get out of the BART at Mission.
Yes,
where
it's straight up squalor.
It's like, what is going on?
Yeah. It's not, like, how can you have this with all this money and everything? But that still exists.
That one fucking corner.
Oh, yeah.
It's fucking exciting.
You
get out there, you're like, thank God.
So it's still exciting if you didn't grow up in that. And you're like, even as a kid.
Like that.
Yeah, even as a kid, I was like, leave me alone.
Yeah.
Stop trying to talk to me. I don't feel sorry for any of you.
But with the husband, did he just move out here? Where were you guys
he
at?
He did.
You were in New York?
I was in New York, and then he moved to San Francisco and to do like startup stuff.
Yeah.
And then I was here and I was like, what are we going to do, buddy? I'm not coming back to San Francisco. And
what are we going to do, buddy?
And I mean, I still can't believe to this day that he moved here.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
Because it was like, I've never had anybody do that before.
Yeah.
And it's still flatters me to this day that he did that.
Yeah.
With, you know, no community for him. I had all my girlfriends from college and everything.
They're all here still?
They're all here, and I love them to death. We all had kids at the same time, mm-hmm. and we all, like, hang out without mm-hmm. the boob and breastfeed together while we, like, complain about our kids.
Is there a place called Boob and Breastfeed?
There's a place called the Pump Station.
Oh, there is?
Where people do get together. Who, like, those are for women who kind of, I think, don't have their tribe yet.
Yeah.
And they need to find their tribe of uh-huh. women who are going through the same shit as them. Uh-huh. And they just, because you need that. Uh-huh. And they gather and they breastfeed together.
Yeah.
And exchange tips on how to breastfeed better.
Uh-huh.
Because it's hard.
Yeah, it's hard. So, like, this special is, you, like, I love that you didn't even really fucking address that you were pregnant till 2/3 of the way in.
Yeah, because it's not about that. I mean, it's my first special. I never wanted to do,
and you just happened to be 7.5 months pregnant.
Well, it was like, I think it was time for me to do, I felt like it was time for me to do a special because I'd been doing stand-up comedy for 10 or so years. And
right.
I was like, I want to put a lot of this material away.
Yeah.
And I had never done, you know, like a half hour or anything like that. And also with the being pregnant thing, like so many people discouraged me from having a kid because they were like, why are you gonna have a kid? We're never gonna see you again.
Yeah.
Because it's true, like female, like it's very rare to see a female comic who has a kid or is pregnant because female stand-up comics don't get pregnant.
Yeah.
Because once they do have a baby, they disappear.
Yeah.
They become a martyr and then they stop doing stand-up. But that's not the case with male stand-up comics. I talk about this on stage. Yeah. Male stand-up comics, they have a baby and they get up on stage like a week after the baby's born. Talk about it, and then they'll like complain about how the baby's shitty and boring and annoying and all these other shitty dads in the audience are like, that's hilarious, I identify, and then their fame just swells because now they're this relatable family funny man all of a sudden, and they get an HBO special and a sitcom deal, and then the mom is at home suffering with bloody nipples, broken pussy, you know, career over. And so like for me, I had a lot of anxiety about it being over once I had a kid. And I was like, I'm not going to let that happen. And I don't want like even like being pregnant to slow me down. So then I like planned it that way because I was like, I need to know for myself that this is not the end. Like having a kid is not the end, that this is that. And I want to associate my baby girl and my pregnancy and having a kid with the beginning.
Yeah.
Of and, something.
And like,
know?
It was funny because, you know, my girlfriend is like, you know, Berkeley art school kind of like painter, feminist, like, you know, kind of full on. She's great.
She's so awesome.
She loves you. But like we're watching it and you're doing your riff on the housewife stuff. And like, I know in my mind that this is really like, you know, more feminist than anything anyone's going to do who's some sort of self-declared feminist. Like, I know what you're doing.
Right.
Because it's like a Trojan horse. Like, you know, you sort of set up this idea, this conceit about wanting to be a housewife.
Yeah.
And then you just blow it up from the inside.
Right.
By, you know, being honest about your own sort of crass and exciting behavior.
Yeah. I mean, I joke that I think feminism is the worst thing that ever happened to women.
Right.
But surely people must understand that I'm joking.
Well,
and that what is more empowering than performing 7 months pregnant?
No, I know. That's why the contradictions and the levels it works at. That's why as a whole piece of stand-up and of, you know, and that there actually is sort of an arc to it.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a one-person show, but, you know, there are callbacks and then there was this revelation at the end that's, you know, that just sort of like, it is completely kind of, I don't know what, it kind of rewrites the whole special in that moment.
Yeah.
But like, it just works on so many levels. The shamelessness about being pregnant, the, you know, the conversations that you're having as a pregnant person, and then sort of like just talking about pregnancy as just another bit.
Right.
And then like all that stuff about housewives, because, you know, what you envied about them was so fucking, you know, kind of disgusting and beautiful.
Yeah.
That like, it you know, it works on both levels, you know, like there's something really feminist about it, but there's also something, you know, liberating to people that may be living that life.
Yeah.
And I think it's empowering for both types of women.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, like I hang out with a bunch of house moms now because I live in Culver City.
Yeah.
There's this park where all the house moms get.
Yeah.
And I talk to them. Some of them are so fucking funny, dude.
Yeah.
And they're so they're raw about their bodies. They're going through some shit every day. They're in the trenches.
Yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
And also, so happy to be housewives. And I don't judge them at all, you know? And I think, like, if that, like, they're living it. They're living the dream, if that's what they, you know, that's what they want to do. But also,
the one thing that's important, I think, that you're saying is that it's when women become mothers, especially early on, you know, they lose a good portion of their identity.
Right.
And so what I hear you saying is that, like, these were all probably, like, pretty, you know, a lot of them might have been really radical chicks.
Yeah.
And then they sort of this shift of identity doesn't mean that personality is gone. They just might not know where to engage it.
Yeah. Well, some of them engage it with their kids. Like, right. I knew a mom who just, like, was like, I think she was probably pretty radical before. I just knew her as a mom. She didn't believe in having her kids do homework.
Yeah.
Cloth diapers. Those women are hardcore who do the cloth diapers. I'm like, Jesus. And then she's still rocking all the armpit hair, everything. And it's like, she's just engaging with her kid, going to war with teachers.
Yeah.
Who are, they're like, why the fuck is your kid not doing homework? And you're like encouraging it, you know? And I'm like, that's awesome, you know?
Yeah.
But you gotta be really... that, like, it's just so weird to me when people have these overarching statements about what it's like to have kids, because it's so different. It's like, do we make any overarching statements about what it's like to have parents? Every parent is different and every kid is different.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it's like breastfeeding, which, what time is it now? Because I might have to pump soon.
10 after 12.
I have to pump. Jesus. I'm long overdue. So... So you don't mind watching this?
No.
It'll be very interesting for you.
Okay.
So basically, with, like, breastfeeding, super sensitive.
Yeah.
Too, because some women don't have time.
Yeah.
And they want to go back to work. Or maybe they don't have enough milk in their breasts to breastfeed. But, like, on the west side of Los Angeles, there are these crazy lactivists that make you feel like your daughter's going to turn into a prostitute if you don't breastfeed, you know?
Lactivists?
Yes, that's like a thing. And I'm like, I breastfeed, but it's hard.
Yeah.
It's like, you'll see now. I have to, you know, do this whole thing in front of you.
Do you,
See, this is leaning in. Breastfeeding in an interview with Marc Maron. Jesus.
But do you have an electric thing, or is it all, is this just
there's
the
an electric thing, and I have a hand pump for when I'm in the car and I'm driving, and I just got a release too.
Yeah. Pump and drive? Can't you pull over? They actually make it for driving, or you just use it that way?
Well, I gotta go some places sometimes and I can't be late, you know? So it's like, I gotta just do this.
Do
you want me to walk you through this? Because I can.
Sure.
Yeah, you don't have to try to talk about something else.
Okay.
I'll just walk you through.
So
I have to I have to wear this bra.
Right.
See, that has holes in it.
Yeah.
For these little funnel cups to go through.
Okay, yeah.
And so.
My mom didn't breastfeed. It was not fashionable.
My mom didn't either. Yeah, it was like.
Yeah.
Okay, then I have to, take this off here.
Yeah. Take the regular bra off.
Take the regular bra. But that's a nursing bra because it's like pull. So then I can just have easy access to
the baby. Oh, I get it.
And then I have to wear these.
So you can switch them out.
I have to wear these pads in here.
So you don't leak?
So that I don't leak all over in public. Then I have to put on this bra. This is what women have to do at work.
Yeah.
When they go back to work.
Yeah.
Up to sometimes like 2 years.
Really?
Yeah. Just every 3 hours. And then a lot of women freak out about their milk production going down.
Yeah.
Because
how long do you do the breastfeeding?
I'm gonna just do it as long as I
keeps
feel like
coming
doing
up.
It. I've been doing it for 5 months now.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to, you know, if I feel like, you know, giving her formula and I feel like not doing it anymore because it's too much, then I'll just switch. You know.
So you rig up one of those pumps to both boobs.
Yeah. So this is. Both boobs, so you get them at the same
time. So you do have the electric thing,
I have an electric thing, and I also have a hand pump too. But the electric is nice because they get in hands free. Then I don't have to.
Do you need to plug it in, or is it?
I think that one still has juice in it.
It's battery.
Yeah. So you'll see. Oh, you can't see it up close, but when it starts coming
out, I could stand up.
Yeah. When you'll see, it's like when it comes out of my nipples, it's quite exciting. It's like the Bellagio fountain. Just the different streams of liquid jumping up and over each other.
Yeah.
See? Can you hear it?
You can hear it.
Oh. Well, sorry, WTF listeners.
Yeah, how long do you pump for?
10 to 15 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. So there it is.
What if you just whiff that off the table a minute? Not that, the machine. That's better.
Is that better? Okay. Yeah. I mean,
so when's it going to happen?
It's happening. It's coming down. I think you just can't see it right now.
Wait, hold on. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Does it, does it pick up speed? Or is that it?
Yeah, it picks up speed. It's called a letdown.
Yeah.
That's when, and I can feel it. It'll, tingle, and then it'll, gush out.
No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But you can't.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you see how it's, coming more frequently now?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, isn't that crazy? My body's a food factory.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I've never seen it before.
Yeah.
This is a first.
Yeah. It's dedication, man.
Yeah.
So I had a C-section.
Yeah.
And in the hospital, I had to, when I was breastfeeding, I was, still recovering from my body being sliced open and then had her chewing on my nipples.
Yeah.
And it was it was rough, dude.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to do it correctly. I was bleeding.
Big learning curve, I guess.
Big learning curve. Raw dog.
You were bleeding?
Bleeding. And she was poor baby girl was spitting up blood.
Why were you bleeding?
Because I was breastfeeding incorrectly.
Really?
I thought the baby's just supposed to suck on your nipple like a straw.
Yeah.
But you have to get them to latch on at a very, it's a whole thing. I never took a class. I should have taken a class. Yeah. I didn't read any parenting books.
No?
No.
And what's your husband do in all this?
My husband,
was he supportive? And were you this is hard? And he was
he was like, we'll be all right. But they can't do anything. It still blows my mind that a woman goes through all of this.
Yeah.
So involved with her body.
Yeah.
And zero happens to a man's body.
You resentful?
Yeah, I'm a little bit resentful. Even now, it's the boob is powerful. It's the only thing that will that will soothe her if she's hungry or something, or if she's fussy.
Yeah.
And I'm the only one who can do it. And she doesn't need his body like she needs my body.
Right.
And I thought it was, I didn't understand how involved breastfeeding was. For 9 months, I was her house.
Yeah.
And I couldn't drink and eat tuna fish.
Yeah.
And do all this stuff. Yeah. And then, do shrooms or ayahuasca anymore. And then now that I'm breastfeeding, I'm her refrigerator. And I still can't drink or do ayahuasca or any of that stuff anymore. It's your body is still so involved.
But are you getting joy out of it?
A lot of joy. Yeah.
Yeah.
That part is really true. Yeah. Yeah. She's great. And she makes me laugh hard. When you've become a comic that doesn't laugh out loud.
Yeah, I can't.
As much anymore. She's her and my husband are and my friends are the only who aren't in comedy are the only things that make me laugh.
Yeah.
Hysterically.
Yeah.
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 She's funny. She's sweet. And all that when people are like, aren't you going to miss doing all the stuff you're able to do? I'm like, yeah, but I get to do other stuff now.
Right.
Well,
you have a good attitude about it.
Yeah. It helps too that all my best friends got pregnant at the same time. So we have a nice tribe, a nice little kula going on.
Did you always knew that you were going to do that? Was there ever a point in comedy, before these other women comics or whoever was advising you not to have kids? Were you always going to have kids?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always had I grew up in a big family.
Yeah.
And.
So you think you're going to have more?
Yeah, I want to have it. I want to try to have three.
Yeah.
I think, yeah. I grew up in a big family, and also I grew up with old parents.
Yeah.
And so I always knew that they were, when you grow up with old parents, you kind of never feel protected, and you're always scared that they're going to die.
Uh-huh.
But thank God I had my siblings.
Yeah.
And so when my dad passed away, I can't imagine going through that and still going through that without any one of my siblings.
Yeah.
And I don't want my daughter to be alone.
Scared of that?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I just want her to grow up with how I did, because it was so fun growing up with my siblings.
I had one. It was good. It was enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. But three's about right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, then there's a little diversity.
Yeah.
Age separation. So, like, what I noticed about the special, you know, is that you really can do a, like, almost like a companion special, like, within a year.
Yeah, I want to.
About childbirth.
Yeah.
Because, like, you were just speculating about it.
Right.
And now, and you were speculating about all this stuff, and based on what you heard, and it seems like the childbirth experience that you had was not as bad in the same way as you were describing in the special. Like the fear.
Yeah.
Like you didn't have to go through prolonged labor, or did you, were you always planned a cesarean, or did,
no,
was that?
I tried to go for vaginal and I was having contractions for 24 hours and then I was like, I give up.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they were like, keep going. I was like, hail to the nah. Cut that shit out. Cut it out. Like Dave Coulier said, cut it out. And then, but this, you know, C-section's no joke. It's real surgery. And then the anesthesiologist missed on my back like 10 times because she was like, your spine is twisted. I was like, your medical education must be twisted because you, I see all these bloody tissues around me. I was like sobbing. She was like, are you crying? I was like, yes, I'm crying because you're stabbing my back with this needle like 10 times. And, it, and before.
And your dad was an anesthesiologist.
My dad was an anesthesiologist. And I was
he would have nailed it.
He would have nailed it. That's what my mom said too. Yeah. That was the first thing she said.
Right.
She's like, your dad would have. Nailed it. But yeah, and then like when my husband came in the room, I had been sobbing. My whole body was shaking. I don't know why. I was freezing, uncomfortable. And I had like, you know, a shower cap on and like, and it just felt, and I was in like this cold room and I was like, we're never having kids again.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, this is it. And then as soon as she came out and I saw her, I was like, let's do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. Really?
Yeah. It's that powerful. It's like, you know. I mean, I've done ayahuasca, but like a kid is like, it's powerful.
So you're saying it's better than ayahuasca?
Oh, way better.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, at least you have your priorities in the right place. Well, let's go back around to that. To that, like, when did you do ayahuasca? Like, when? How did your husband get involved with that? Because you talk in the special a little bit about being a little bit, not hippie, but, you know, kind of, I don't know what you'd call it now, but it's kind of hippie shit.
Yeah, it's like new age stuff.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Now everybody does ayahuasca. But
I know,
he,
it seems to be popular.
He did it when like not everybody was doing it.
Yeah.
And we went to Mexico and I thought it was going to be like
I talked to one other person about this, Simon Amstel.
Oh.
Yeah.
We went with all of these, I thought it was going to be all of these like hippie white people with dreadlocks.
Yeah.
From like Portland and Seattle or something.
Yeah.
And it was all Mexican women dealing with like, you know, it's like personal stuff like divorce or, you know, their kids getting into trouble or relatives. It was like, it was really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And it was hard. Like the first, we did it two nights the first time, and the first night I just like threw up and it was scary and I had diarrhea because that's what happens, they call it purging. And then at the time I had like this really bad like I had rosacea, I had like really bad skin on my face and I didn't know why, and I had, and then this shaman there told me that your skin is a reflection of your lack of self-esteem and your body is punishing you for thinking that you're ugly. Yeah, it was really weird. And then I...
Did that fit?
Yeah, it did. Because like for some reason, I was like in New York and I was like eating pizza and getting fat and I had bad skin. And I was like, I was feeling like really ugly.
Yeah.
And then that... And then I did it and I had this like in my journey. Gosh, I think I went on this journey where like...
So you do it three times? Before, like, you did it the first night?
You're supposed to do it three nights, but we missed our flight, and we didn't make it the first night.
Right.
But the first... So we only did it twice the first time. And the first night was, like, bad, and I didn't have a good experience.
Yeah.
And the second night, I went on this, like, beautiful journey where, like, I met myself.
Yeah.
Like a, you know, how you dream, but you don't see, like, yourself. You just see other people.
Right.
I literally met, like, a double of myself, and we went on this, like, romantic date, and we had fun, and we were, like... fucking in a barn, like I ate my pussy.
You ate
in
your own pussy.
Yes, and it was like super fun, laughing hysterically, and then I was like, I'm fun, I'm beautiful, I'm like, I want to eat my pussy. And it was like a show don't tell thing, you know, like people can tell you like, you're beautiful, what are you talking about, you're skinny, and that you're skinny, you're great, you're like, you're amazing. But I experienced myself being fun, and it was great.
And it changed your life?
I mean, it changed, like, yeah, what your I needed for then. And then when my dad died, you know, I had, like, a really hard time with that, as people do when their parents die. And, you know, I was able...
Was it a surprise? I mean, was he sick?
It was a surprise, yeah. He was sick, but it was a surprise.
Yeah.
Still. And it was, like, really hard. It was not, like, a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
You know, the journey, like, I really, I felt...
This is the second time you did it?
This was maybe the second or third time I did it. In a different location, like in Santa Cruz. And I felt him suffering.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, made a little bit more peace with him passing because I felt like I felt it and I threw up and it was really hard.
Yeah.
But
so it forced you into like a sort of fragile state of deep empathy for
totally
his suffering
and
it was able to temper the grief a bit.
Yeah.
Your loss, you know, you were able to frame it differently in knowing that, you know, it was time.
Yeah. Like and I felt suffering like from my mom too. Mm-hmm. Like, and I felt like I was like lying down in the, what do you call it? The yurt.
The yurt.
You're in the yurt.
Sure.
And I was lying down in the yurt and because I couldn't sit up anymore because I could just feel all this pressure on my shoulders.
Yeah.
And like, it was like suffering.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, this is like a fraction of what my dad felt because he was sick. And
what did he have?
He had cancer.
Yeah.
And he couldn't deal with it
anymore,
you know? And then for my mom as the caretaker, it was tough.
Did he like take his own life?
He was depressed. I mean, he was like, he was sick. He had cancer and he was depressed.
Terminal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he had cancer and he was sick. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think that's probably still like the worst thing that's ever happened to me is my dad passing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the ayahuasca thing, how do you manage your emotions? Is it, you know, is there a guide there? I mean, was there a point where you thought you'd get lost in, or like, is it like a trip?
There is like a shaman to guide the whole thing, but the whole point is you're supposed to go through it yourself and you don't want people like rubbing your back.
Yeah.
You don't want people like talking to you and touching you.
Yeah.
Like whatever's happening to you, even if like you're screaming and like seeing demons or whatever, like there's a reason why you're supposed to go through it. So.
And did you talk about this stuff with your husband after and shit?
Yeah, of course. He doesn't always like to talk about what happened, and he's a little bit more private about it because I think then maybe it sort of colors what the journey actually was when you put it in a frame.
Right.
But I don't mind.
You see this as a practical therapeutic thing to do a couple times a year.
Yeah, like I said, it's like a show don't tell thing because, you know, people can tell you like, you know, your dad was sick, he was suffering, and he led a good life.
Yeah.
But I saw all of that. And people told me that, and I couldn't hear it.
Right.
But once I saw all that, I was able to, like, deal with it a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would... I had a miscarriage, and I don't think about it that much now.
You talk about it in the special.
I do talk about it in the special.
And that's another thing that you sort of, like, unpacked in terms of... Like, there's a lot of things in the special that... You know, from the mundane to, you know, the sort of intense that, you know, are shame triggers for a lot of women.
Right.
And you just fucking unload them.
Yeah, I wish women didn't have to feel so shamed about it because, you know, a lot of the wrong question.
It's a great joke, though.
Thank you. The wrong question to ask a woman who's had a miscarriage is why?
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of question is that, you know? And some people even, like, said to me, like, oh, is it because, you know, you were too active and, like, performing a lot or, like, and it's like...
They want to shame you. It's literally, that's shaming.
Yeah, or they just want to find a reason why. And it's like, with miscarriages, it's so common. And if women knew how common it was, they wouldn't blame themselves so much and be so secretive about it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But and unfortunately... You know, I talked about it even, and people felt uncomfortable with it because I think people usually only talk about the fact they had a miscarriage after they have like a full term pregnancy.
Yeah.
But I had told people early on that I was pregnant, like week four, which you're not supposed to do.
Right, right.
And then I was like, I don't understand why people keep it a secret. And then I was like, oh.
This is why.
Now I understand why people secret. Because you don't want to deal with people asking you why.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, now we're ending the pumping. You see?
Oh, yeah. How do you know it's done? They didn't fill up all the way.
It's 15 minutes. Oh. No, I mean, she doesn't need it to fill up all the way. Some women have it fill up all the way.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
This is like, I mean, this is how much she needs like in a feeding.
Uh-huh. And do you have to eat certain things to make milk production or any of that?
Oatmeal's good.
Really?
There's a tea called mother's milk that's good. Yeah, fenugreek.
Oh, yeah. That's the Indian spice.
Yeah.
So you were now with the C-section, because you talk a lot about, you know, the ripping of the vagina.
Yes.
You were able to avoid that?
Yeah, that's all intact. But, you know, I mean, who cares?
Yeah.
It's not put to like much use these days. So it's like, you know, I mean, when you have a, see, then I got to dab it afterwards.
Right.
After, you know, like I thought I was going to die when the anesthesiologist kept missing on my back.
Yeah. Because it's a spinal tap, right?
I thought I was going to die or become like paralyzed from her messing up my spine. And at that point I was like, I do not care. I just want to get the baby out safely first. Like the mama instinct kicked in real quick.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care if I die.
Yeah.
But just please get her out safely.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, but it's just crazy how your body, like I had some friends too, who like, they labored for like 72 hours and then they still had to have a C-section. Their pussies straight up look like, they showed me afterwards, straight up look like two hanging dicks side by side. Hardcore.
Yeah.
In the process of giving birth to a baby girl, they became a dude. Yeah. Two dudes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I was like, I mean, it's just crazy what happens to women's bodies. These moms now who I meet are like the funniest, most raw women I've ever met, that, you know, talking about their hemorrhoids and stuff.
Yeah.
And they're not talking about, like, they're not hacky talking about hemorrhoids, because we've heard the hacky hemorrhoid mom jokes at the park.
Like, right. Oh, yeah.
Really funny.
You judge, you know, you're like, I heard that one.
Yeah, heard that one. Yeah.
you got to get a new angle on that.
Yeah.
So tell me how long you've been writing television professionally. Like you're on fresh off the boat?
Yes, that's been happening for 2 years. I'm really good friends with the lead actor, Randall Park. I know him from, we did comedy, like sketch comedy stuff together. And he, you know, was like, why don't you come in and write for the show?
Yeah?
And then, yeah. And
how
then,
is it? You're in the room? How many people in the room?
13.
Big.
Big, but then, you know, once the season starts going and we lose the showrunner, it's a lot, because there's always people on set, people, you know, having to be off on script. So you really need, and you have to split the room into two to try to break two stories at once. So
you working with Jake Kasdan?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't see him that often.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Lynn Shelton directed a bit.
Yes.
She's great.
She's great.
Yeah, I love her. She directed a couple of mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's so awesome.
Yeah. And the writing, like, Sarah, who watches the show occasionally, my girlfriend, said that the mother character sounds a lot like you. Like,
oh,
you
that's funny. There's like, you know, I mean, I write on the show, and there's definitely, I would hope, part of me that people can see in the show. It's been great. Like, I didn't ever set out to be a TV writer. Have you ever done it?
Just for my show.
Just for your show. With TV writing too, I think as a stand-up comic, you gotta watch out, because it can be, it's comfortable.
Right.
You know, and it can be a trap. And I was talking to Tom Papa about it, because I think some comics, they get into TV writing.
Oh, yeah, that's it.
And that might not be the thing that they set out to do.
Yeah.
You know, but then they fall into it and it gets comfortable. And they get into it before they find their own voice.
Right.
And then it's like, you're stuck there. And then when you're like 40, sometimes in TV writing, they don't want you anymore because you're too old.
Yeah.
And then they can't, they try to come back to stand up and it's too hard, you know? It's
right. Like, you know, like I don't get the sense, I haven't gotten the sense too many times that they're coming back to stand up to actually start making money as a stand up.
Right.
Because like, I always framed it like, you know, not everyone's cut out to fucking live the life of a comic.
Right.
And when young people ask me about comedy, I'm like, well, you know, if you can write jokes,
Yeah.
And, you know, and you want to do comedy, just realize that the jobs that are available to you are, you know, if you can't cut it as a stand-up. I mean, I don't necessarily wish that on anybody. It takes a unique person
right.
to find their voice.
Yeah.
And some dudes, a lot of the dudes that I started out with, they did comedy, they did stand-up, but they practically, like normal human beings realize, like, I ain't going to be one of the 10 guys that makes money at this.
Right.
This is going to be a long, hard life, but I have this talent.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go into writing.
Yeah.
So I try to frame it that way.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I imagine a lot of them have regret or whatever, but who the hell knows if they'd ever find their voice or actually make a living as a comic that could support a family and get right. them insurance and everything. I just think that, you know, it's always been that way. You know, these guys that do comedy, okay.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe even remember them. But, you know, they go make the big fucking dollars. You know, writing for shows, becoming showrunners, becoming producers.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's a whole other trajectory. I don't begrudge them. Like, I don't judge them negatively at all.
No, I don't either. And I think, like, if they enjoy doing it, if that's what they wanted to do. But for me personally, like, I don't want to... like get into it and then lose like
well you're the real deal like thing. There's you're not you know you're a rare you know there's very few people that respect stand-up for stand-up really anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a sad thing, and I think that the army of amateurs that, you know, can get stage time in their little corner, you right. know, sometimes for years, have sort of diminished what it means to really call yourself a stand-up comic.
Right.
There's not that many of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you seem to have that in perspective. And, you know, I hear some of it as self-talk. You know, like, you yeah. know, I'm not fucking stop. Like, you're actually telling yourself yeah. as you're telling me.
I hope so. But, like, something's got to give, right? Because, like, if I'm working during the day at a writing job till, like, 6 p.m., yeah. sometimes, like, 8 p.m., then it's like, and I'm doing a run to the store. When am I going to see my kid? You know, well, like something's got to give at some point. And then like I have to, you know, I don't know. I mean, I have to get back into that like uncomfortable, like pure stand-up zone again, too.
Yeah, but
like,
it comes back pretty quick. And, yeah. you know, and you're, you know, it doesn't seem like, you know, you're at risk of having complete peace of mind anytime soon.
Right. Yeah. Let's hope not.
But like, I think also that there's some, you know, a gratitude available to you in that, you know, it's nice to have the job and to have, you know, some security and have the insurance. And like you said, like, you know, you don't need to go do B rooms for nobody for a living.
Right.
Which is a gift. And, you know, you're still compulsive about doing the work and you're going out and doing the work and the special's fucking great. And, you know, hopefully you'll get a little draw
yeah.
or you find an angle, you know, where people want to come see you and recognize you that way. So then when you go out on the road, it can be sort of a special one night thing, not a three night yes. thing. And you know what I mean?
Yeah, I hope so.
I want that for you.
I want that.
I think you deserve
too.
It, man. I really, I mean, I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. I don't really do that. I've always admired your guts and your fucking style. And, you know, the writing is fucking great. And, you know, no one really is doing what you do.
Oh, thank you.
As a comic, like you take, you know, you really push it, you know, in a great way. You know, it's smart, it's dirty, it means something, and you know, I loved it, and I love talking to you.
Thanks so much.
What do we got to do with that milk now?
Oh, I
you just
have
put
to
it in the little thing
in
we
the put
in the freezer.
That I put in your freezer, yeah.
All right, you want some ice cream?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that'd be great.
Great. I love it. I saw a new thing. I experienced a new thing. I don't have children. I don't have a wife. So the pumping was sort of a big deal for me. And I'm glad you guys were all there with me for that experience. It was, she's a fucking stud, man. Ali Wong's special Baby Cobra premieres on Netflix tomorrow, Friday, May 6th. All right, go to WTFpod.com for all that stuff. Watch my show, Marin, on IFC on Wednesdays at 9. If you miss them, you can go to IFC.com, Amazon, or iTunes. All right? Okay. Whew, man, I should rest my voice, right? I should play some guitar or something. Yeah.
Boomer